A Russian soldier has been detained after opening fire on colleagues at an army base close to the Mongolian border. Eight were killed with another two injured.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Political crisis in Israel. Netanyahu gives up attempts to form a government again for the second time this year. Last time he just had another general election. This time, could it be the end for Bibi as the corruption charges loom? And Australian newspapers blanked out their covers, redacted covers, because of blatant attacks by the state on all sorts of Aussie media. We hear from one of the editors. And also Julian Assange appears in court this week. He's looking very ill. Is the greatest investigative journalist of the 20th century an internet pioneer being snuffed out with drugs? And on the tail and on the trail of Nazi Party's brute of a treasurer, Martin Bormann. This week, the Bristol Connection, the Jewish refugee and local journalist who tracked Bormann down in the 1970s and paid heavily for his trouble. And for the first time, a photograph of Bormann taken in Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires, in the early 1970s. Sure looks like him. It's the first one I've seen. Easy to do photos on the radio, though. And the power of debate, what the lies and trivia in the mass media, what dumbing down really means. And Jewish colleague of Zionism author Stephen Sizer, Mr. Getmer, gets a surprise as he traces his DNA roots. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon this week. Is the VI paedophile scandal dead after the 18-year jail sentence for survivor Carl Beach? Certainly not if former Met detective John Wedger, an assistant to Chris Fay, who wrote down the Elm guest house list dictated to him by the owner who subsequently suicided Carol Cassier, get their way. This week we hear more evidence of pimps freely accessing children's homes all over the country. Some chief constables have been pursuing these rich and powerful criminals, while others turn a blind eye, allowing officers who uncover evidence to be bullied out of their jobs, and worse. So where does your chief constable stand? A Mike Veal or a Cressida Dick? You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. And I think we'll start, Martin, this week with that story from John Wedger, who I interviewed earlier this week. The fallout really has been the arrest, the trial, and the sentencing of 18 years of Carl Beach has sent a bit of a shockwave out there. Many people now thinking, well, there's no point in going talking to the police. I could end up behind bars.
Well, I think there's a lot of things need to be said about that. I mean, an 18-year sentence, this is terribly punitive. And, of course, the jury were told that he downloaded child pornography, which then, of course, prejudiced the jury against him. But, of course, any psychologist would tell you, people who have been abused, that's the sort of thing they end up doing. They end up taking drugs as well. They end up drinking too much. They end up homeless. That's what the child abuse does to people.
Now, one of the things John Wedger has pointed out, a former Met detective, is that there's been a change in the law in the last 10 years that enables people's character to be looked on effectively as a liar, and this is then introduced into the court case, and this happened with the Carl Beach case as well.
The jury was sent out when various pertinent things were brought forward about Harvey Proctor, which are now, he's now claiming he's been exonerated and he wants further, further pound of flesh.
He wants the police punished too.
Oh, yeah. Well, he wanted young boys punished. That's what the evidence was all about.
Originally, back in the 1980s. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to a clip from the interview with John Wedger. So it's former detective constable in the Metropolitan Police, John Wedger.
I have stated this very, very clearly, Tony, in a number of my talks. In 2003, the Criminal Justice Act rolled out a bit of legislation in respect to bad character. Right, and it was seen as a real step forward in criminal justice, that someone, for instance, was up for burglary and they wasn't allowed to reduce the fact that they'd committed numerous burglaries during the trial. It was only post-trial, upon conviction or on mitigation or on release, that their previous convictions would be mentioned. So they brought this legislation saying that they can bring it in during a trial, and everyone said, well done. But I saw this as a very, very sinister bit of legislation, and that is exactly what's happened. A lot of people that have been abused fall foul of the law. Now, people self-medicate for many reasons, and abuse is one of them reasons. And the medication they tend to use is heroin. Now, heroin, is a class A drug, very powerful drug, and it is a very powerful analgesic. It's a painkiller. Now, in order to fund that expensive drug habit, people tend to, once their savings are gone, if they had any to start with, they will turn to crime. One of the most obvious forms of crime is shoplifting. And 9 times out of 10, they'll get away with it, but every now and then they'll get caught. So they'll get caught, and then they'll get a conviction, and that conviction will be for theft. Theft is classed as a dishonest crime. So they then get labelled as a person of dishonesty. Right? So with that tag, they are then classed as dishonest. Now, if someone is given evidence in court, years later, this said heroin addict decides that they want to speak out about the abuse that they endured as a child, and they want to name their perpetrators, they make an allegation, a very, very serious allegation, and then they go to court, and then they are classed, before it really, even the trial begins, as a person of dishonesty. Now, if you say someone's dishonest, what word conjures up straight in your mind? It's not thief, shoplifter, it's liar. Liar, you see? And this is exactly what has happened in the recent trial of Carl Beach. And I've been saying this all the way through. We are going to see the sources of information brutally attacked.
Now, he's had a sentence of 18 years, which, I mean, many people have said is a bit excessive, but he has been shown to, apparently, according to the jury, and this is, not the judge saying this, the jury has decided he's guilty, John.
Say that again, sorry, Tony.
The jury has decided he's guilty, John, not the judge, a jury.
Well, of course, I mean that is our judicial system. Now, not everyone who is found guilty is guilty, and we've seen many cases of travesties of justice. If that was a case, we wouldn't have the appeal courts, which we have, and they're constantly busy. But also, those that get not guilty, that doesn't mean that they haven't done it. It's just that the very high benchmark of the burden of proof in the UK, which is the highest in the Western world, hasn't been attained. It's just one of them things, and maybe he did it. Maybe he did it, but the sentence is very much over the top, and this bloke was a victim. Now, what went against him is the fact that he has a very, very dubious criminal past, which involves sexual offences and those against children. So the man could be well classed as a paedophile, and I no doubt he was on the sex offenders register. I haven't looked too deeply into it. Okay, that's not good. That aside, he was a victim, and I spoke to a former colleague who knows one of the senior investigating officers on his case and said that they all believed him. Now, what we've seen happen is that his criminal past was brought in during the trial. Therefore, that left the game open for his defence team to attack the prosecution.
Well, yeah, but the police may have believed him, John, but the jury didn't, it seems.
Well, of course. Well, they didn't. And that's that. I mean, that's just how it goes. I mean, like I said, he made he got found guilty because he may well have been guilty.
Okay, what do you make of the chief commissioner, is it, of the Met, the top person?
What, Cressida Dick?
Yeah. What do you make of her? Do you have any faith that she will make a difference?
No, of course she will not. And I'm in court with her next year, so I'm not going to say too much. I'm suing her, her and her force, for the cover-ups of child prostitution. And I said to her in a meeting, and I said, it was meant to be just me and her. When I turned up this meeting, that she was there with 9 other officers, all women, all sat around a table. Whether that was for intimidation or to back herself up or what, I don't know. Anyway, I had something to say and I said it. And I said to her, I can go to a children's home. I can find a vulnerable girl. I can have sex with that girl, groom that girl, get my friend to do the same. We can then get that girl and we can pimp her out, for want of a better term, make money out of it and get her to get her friend involved so we can do the same to them. And you, Cressida, have not employed one officer. And bear in mind, when I expose this, they shut down the inquiry, right, and they never investigated another case. And when I expose this, this was in 2006. So I had this meeting with Cressida. I think this was circa 2014, maybe 2013, I'm not too sure. For nearly 7-year period, like, she did not employ one person to deal with this most heinous of crimes.
Well, that's former Met Detective John Wedger there, Martin. I mean, he's basically, I mean, he was, should we say, politicised by, as a detective, coming across systematic pimping going on in children's homes in London. And then he found that his bosses simply defunded his office. He finally he didn't have any support staff, and then eventually he himself was sacked.
Yeah, well, underlying all of this VI paedophile stuff, I mean, obviously paedophilia is a general problem in society, but the VIP stuff, I think, is very much linked to blackmail operations by the intelligence services. Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, which they wanted to exclude from the inquiry that they were carrying on the grounds that it wasn't part of the British jurisdiction, which is news to the provisional IRA. But, of course, they were using that, MI5 were using Kinkora, and this is widely understood in Northern Ireland and all sides of the community, as a blackmail tool. So people were going in there having sex with underage boys. Those boys were then taken, some of them, to other parts of the country. And it's pretty clear that MI5, MI6 have been using paedophilia to blackmail political figures for a long time. That's why it's been covered up.
Love Bristol. Love, love, love. BCFM 93.2.
On the media side of things, we really must have a little peep at what's been going on in Australia. Extraordinary scenes at the beginning of the week with all the Australian newspapers all printing their front pages with blanked out front pages with all sorts of interesting words blanked out. What they're saying there is there's a concerted effort by the intelligence services and the government in Australia to stop them reporting, for example, crimes like those of their special forces in Afghanistan.
Indeed, and of course they're doing absolutely nothing to help their national Julian Assange. She was dragged to Westminster Court.
Their media is right behind him.
Yeah, but the government has basically thrown him to the wolves.
A very difficult situation, isn't it? If you're a journalist and you've got ex-special forces people coming to you saying, we did this, this happened, that happened, you're simply not allowed to report it. Now, they're actually putting their neck on the line under official secrets and things like that, but then they find that nothing comes out. So not only does a journalist potentially get arrested, jailed, their career ended, also whoever it is who's the whistleblower is attacked.
Well, indeed, and that's why they're attacking Assange. They're making his life an absolute misery, so that anybody who is thinking of engaging in any kind of investigative journalism would think very hard about whether they wanted to do that.
Now, the latest on Assange this week is he's not looking at all well. It looks as if he may be going to the US, and nobody really knows what's going on with his case, apart from insiders in the judiciary, which looks extremely fishy, should we say.
They seem to be taking instructions from the US embassy.
They do, don't they? Yeah. So what do you think? You know, he's being drugged, I believe, in some way.
Well, he's not allowed to see his lawyers. He's being kept in solitary confinement. He's not allowed to use computers. And
what has he done?
is supposed to have broken the Espionage Act in the United States, even though he's not been in the United States and he's an Australian citizen, he's in Britain. But the Americans apparently can tell our courts what to do, and they have been telling our courts what to do, and that's why we need sovereignty from Brussels to some of the Americans will stop telling us what to do. That's what's really shocking to me is how little the mainstream political class, you know, the MPs, have. I mean, Chris Williamson has put forward an early day motion in support of Assange and demanding his release. But basically, this is happening in plain sight. A journalist is being ruthlessly persecuted by a foreign government and our court. This is the home of Magna Carta, as I was saying earlier on Russia Today. This is the home of Magna Carta, and this guy is being held against something that's not even illegal in this country to please a political faction in a foreign state. Absolutely outrageous.
So the Trump administration has used a secret live stream to spy on Julian Assange. This is in Mint Press News this week. Working directly with Ecuador's corrupt government, the US government abandoned all sense of legality and moral decency by spying on Assange 24 hours a day via an illegal live stream surveillance operation set up by a private security firm and approved by Ecuador's president whilst he was in the embassy.
Well, indeed, and of course he's being held in solitary confinement in Belmarsh with no access to the outside world, no access to computers, etc. If that is torture, they're also drugging him up, quite obviously. He's obviously drugged out of his mind when he came to court, and they're now moving his next appeal to Belmarsh prison itself so that nobody can get in to see the actual court proceeding. And of course, in Ecuador itself, Lenin Moreno is facing a massive uprising from the people. Because he was given an IMF loan, which then pays back the banks that lent the money to Ecuador. It doesn't do anything for Ecuador.
Sounds like a payday loan for Ecuador.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. It's a Wonga loan. And of course, he's had to massively increase petrol prices, which basically cutting the wages of the poorest people in the country, and they're not having it. They're out there rebelling, as they are in Chile. And of course, if this was Venezuela or Hong Kong, we'd be hearing all about it and how terrible it was, and the evil government, etc. But because the people rebel, and in Honduras and in Haiti, we've also got rebellions. But of course, there are rebellions and there are rebellions. You see. If you're rebelling against people that the West doesn't like, then you're a hero.
Well, Caitlin Johnson is a US journalist who's written something which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Only cowards and sadists support the persecution of Assange. I was actually on the National Union of Journalists Facebook page earlier this week, asking people to watch the documentary about people are just accusing him of being a rapist without actually having looked at
the
facts are. So the documentary is called Sex, Lies and Julian Assange. It was done by Four Corners, which is a documentary strand on ABC in Australia, and it's an absolutely fascinating insight into the motivations of the smear campaign and a honey trap which tried to turn and failed to turn really Julian Assange into a rapist. So former British ambassador Craig Murray has published a very disturbing account of Julian Assange court appearance, which Caitlin recommends we read in full there have been many reports published about Assange case management hearing, but the combination of Murray's prior experience with torture victims, his familiarity with the British courts, his friendship with Assange, his lack of reverence for Western power structures allowed for a much more penetrating insight into what happened than anyone else has been able to provide so far, Martin.
Yeah, well, Craig Murray was in court, but he says what's going to happen now? The next hearing is going to be held inside Belmarsh prison itself. They've got some kind of courtroom that they've got in there. And the only people who ever tried in those courtrooms are top-level terrorists who've got to be under complete... they're basically treating him as if he was the most extreme kind of terrorist. And of course, there's no basis for this at all. Even if he was going to be extradited, they could let him. He could basically be allowed to go home while this rubbish case proceeds.
What Craig has said, Martin, is that in Westminster Magistrates Court, the decision was railroaded through over the scarcely heard arguments and objections of Assange's legal team by a magistrate who barely pretended to be listening.
That's right. Well, I mean, the legal team were arguing, as is quite right, they should. There is no, you cannot be extradited from this country for a political offence in a foreign country. But we are treating this come-on by the US authorities as if it's got the force of British law. And we're also doing it to somebody who isn't even a British citizen.
So Assange,
it's absolutely bizarre.
He's gone from an investigative journalist to a wreck, it seems. What Craig Murray says is he, when asked to give his name and date of birth, he struggled visibly over several seconds to recall both. I'll come to an important content of his statement at the end of proceedings in due course, but his difficulty in making it was very evident. It was a real struggle for him to articulate the words and focus his train of thought, even on his own name.
Well, basically, he's being subjected to psychological torture. And the other thing that's really extraordinary is that he's not allowed to see his lawyers. His lawyers aren't being allowed in to talk to him. Because, you know, if you can't defend yourself, your lawyers are supposed to defend you, but they're not even being given access to him. And the other thing is he's not being given access to computers, books, etc. He's being kept in permanent solitary confinement under the liquid cosh, and he's not actually done anything. He's not a criminal. It's absolutely, it's disgusting.
It's sending a message,
the mainstream.
Martin, it's sending a message out to investigative journalists in this country, isn't it? Look, if you start digging out any facts, for example, the fact that the CIA is using hacking of cars to assassinate people,
yep.
Is using televisions, even when they're on standby, to spy on people. There's a whole range of stuff that Assange has managed to get out to the public. Then this is what's going to happen to you.
Well,
he
also uncovered the fact that the Democratic National Committee were rigging the primaries against Bernie Sanders last time round. And of course, they're doing exactly the same thing this time round against Tulsi Gabbard. And of course, it's all pertinent stuff. But for reporting it, he is being accused of being a Russian agent.
So why aren't the whole entire British press on his side and cheering for him?
Because they're bought and paid for, Tony. You know what it's about.
Okay, we're talking about the
If you want to keep your job and a mortgage and your kids in private school, you've got to keep your mouth shut.
What about the Australian press? We hear here from the BBC World Service, which is paid for by the Foreign Office, and they had a report on earlier this week, which is with a woman called Lisa Davis. And that was on World Update. And she's, I believe, the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. But anyway, we'll find out now.
Well, I spoke to Lisa Davis, who is editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. She told me how the newspapers came together to organise this event.
A number of media outlets, which already are affiliated with an organisation called Australia's Right to Know. They had been talking for some time about how we could best combine our resources to stage a campaign of awareness to identify a series of issues that we feel have led to a great deal of restriction on our ability to report on what is going on in this country.
The specifics were that there was a report making allegations about the special forces, and it was a reference from the, I think, chief of the defence staff, who said there must be classified information that's been leaked. That was what started the federal police on their route towards the ABC and the Herald. Is that right?
They're two separate things. The first one was, in fact, a six-hour raid on the home of a journalist, Annika Smethurst, who writes.
Yeah, I heard
the
they
Herald
went through
Sun
her underwear drawer. Is that
true? They went through everything, and the story she had written revealed a proposal for Electronic Intelligence Agency, our Australian Signals Directorate, to take on an expanded role. And that was a pretty high level leak, if indeed that's what it was. And clearly, someone was concerned that that had been put into the public arena. But so that was on June 4, and then on June 5, the ABC was raided over accusations of war crimes committed by Australia's special forces in Afghanistan. Multiple reporters were named in the warrant, and that came just a week after a former military lawyer was committed to stand trial over leaking of documents to the ABC.
Has the mood and the environment in which journalists operate in Australia, has that changed then?
We would say that over many years, there's been just a general encroachment of our right and ability to do our jobs. This is in a number of areas, freedom of information laws, protection for whistleblowers. We're calling, as part of this campaign, which of course had every single national and metropolitan newspaper in the country with a redacted sort of blacked out front page, we're calling for a number of things to occur. And one of them is the basic right to contest a search warrant.
And that's one of your demands. You have five others. Perhaps you could tell us about those.
So that's sort of the first one. The second one is protections for whistleblowers. So expanding the safeguards for whistleblowing as it reflects government behaviour. Another one is restrictions on secrecy. So looking at new rules governing what information governments can deem secret with obligations to audit the material that is kept from the public. Fourthly, there's the freedom of information reform. So our current FOI laws are an absolute disaster, frankly. And in fact, one of my senior investigations journalists got told last week that it would take 18 months for someone to process her request to access a file. The system is unworkable. There's also examination of the exemptions to protect journalists for prosecution under some of the national security laws, and also defamation law reform. I mean, this is quite a contentious issue, and there are a number of inquiries already underway. It's totally out of step with the modern digital era in this country, and there are inconsistencies across our state borders that we really would like to see streamlined and adaptable to the current environment.
So that was Lisa Davis, editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, Martin. The most important, I suppose, of those is the idea that the Electronic Intelligence Agency, the Signals Directorate, they call it in Australia, is going to be directing its interest, not so much abroad, but actually having a domestic role. So doing a lot more spying on people in Australia. Now, that, of course, could include journalists. It could include politicians. It could include lawyers. And actually, many people in the government, we hear from the Sydney Morning Herald, are concerned about this, and yet they're not supposed to be reporting on it. And their journalist, Annika Smethurst, was raided as a result.
Well, I mean, the Five Eyes, what they call the Five Eyes, were the countries which have basically spied.
That is a weird one, isn't it? Yeah. Because actually it should be 10 eyes, because there's five countries.
Yes,
but
right.
No.
But there's the Eye of Sauron in each country.
Each country has only got the Illuminati eye.
The point about that was, is the British would spy on the Americans because it's a foreign country. That they used to get round this by doing that, so they could spy on each other's citizens. You know, the Americans would spy on the British would spy on the Americans, and they'd share all the intel.
There's actually some talk that the chap that was the husband of the woman who ran over Harry Dunn, I think it was, a few weeks ago, up at RAF Croughton. That's exactly what he was doing at Croughton, is using a US National Security Agency to spy on US citizens from Britain, or to spy on British citizens, I suppose, to spy on American citizens from Britain, and therefore it's around the American law.
I mean, anybody who thinks that we're not being constantly spied on by the government is living in cloud cuckoo land. That's been going on 4 years. There's no legal basis for it. And of course, the fact is that they've done it, as Snowden's pointed out. I mean, he's obviously living in Russia now, but he said, you know, they're spying on everybody, and of course they've got the computers now to carry out the surveillance.
Well,
in the past, it was really difficult because without computers, you can't analyse the information you've gathered.
Politicians, journalists, and lawyers. If you're able to spy on them, you can, for example, identify a story before it comes out and stop it being published. Mm. You can fix a court case by spying on the opposition, and you can stop legislation.
Well, as the Institute for Statecraft and the Integrity Initiative were exposed, funded by the British government and effectively involved in psychological warfare in Britain against targets that they regard as the enemy. And of course, the Special Demonstration Squad, the Human Intelligence, hundreds of police officers infiltrating radical and other movements in this country. It's been going on for years. Basically, we've got a soft Stasi state in this country, and it's not really that soft when you look at what's happening to Julian Assange, and if you look at the history of the troubles that's been on the BBC 4 over the last few weeks. Basically, people think they have a democracy,
it's a delusion. Because they're now talking, aren't they, about making it impossible to prosecute former army members from Northern Ireland.
Well, indeed, and of course, what really underlies that is the fact that the British Army and Force Research Unit with Brigadier Gordon Kerr was orchestrating the whole of the Loyalist terror campaign and heavily infiltrated inside the IRA. State Knife may come to trial now, but the British Army don't want him to come to trial because he was their agent.
Well,
so all the people he killed, they okayed it.
Most of
and
them.
They should be in prison, but they're not in prison. They've all got gongs and pats on the back.
Most of them get run over and things like that, don't they?
Well, indeed. And I think this is the reality, you know, when people say that basically that we have an oligarchy and a security state to back up that oligarchy, and democracy is largely a sham.
I mean, the foreign policy seems to be mostly regime change, and domestic policy seems to roll out the police state.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been going down this road for quite a few decades now. And each time we come to another, I mean, you know, if there is another financial crisis, which may very likely happen, all the machinery is in place to repress the population if it rises up against it.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
So Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel's, he's having all sorts of trouble. He's just putting a government together this week. So I thought we'd play another clip from the World Service, which is with a reporter who has been, actually she's a Israeli reporter. And I'm not quite sure of her name, but she'll hear it now. This is another clip from the World Service.
Well, I spoke to Lahav Harkov, senior contributing editor at the Jerusalem Post newspaper. I asked her, what does this mean for the future of Benjamin Netanyahu?
It's still unclear. It could be the end of an era. It could be that he's coming to the close of his over a decade as prime minister. But it's not over yet. We don't know for sure. I mean, aside from the fact that he's still interim prime minister until we have a government, but if Benny Gantz, who will soon start trying to form his own government, if he fails, then there's a period in which the parliament can vote and choose someone to be prime minister. And then whoever gets the majority, any member of parliament, can be that prime minister, which means that Netanyahu will still be in play.
Why is Israel so divided that it's had two goes to form a government and failed?
Well, it's in part because there's a clear majority for the right wing if you look at how the votes came out, except that one of the right wing parties has decided to sort of stake out a secularist position and focus on issues of religion and state, and in a very different way from the other parties in the right wing bloc, which tend to be more religious and traditional and not want to bring those kinds of changes when it comes to matters of religion and state. And so while there's a very clear majority for the right wing, one of those parties took those right wing votes and turned them into swing votes.
And because the issue of the privileges, and that's what they're described, for the Orthodox, that was what changed things.
The ultra-Orthodox. The modern Orthodox, they serve in the military, they go to schools where they learn math and science. It's the ultra-Orthodox that's exempted from the military, and that was one of the big issues that really was one of the catalysts of the early elections that were called 10 months ago. And that's sort of one of the major things that kept a coalition from being formed after an election in April. And it's still part of it now, even though it's less of what's being discussed at the moment.
Tell us about Benny Gantz, then.
Benny Gantz is the former chief of staff of the IDF, and he's a political newcomer. If he becomes prime minister, he would be the first prime minister who had never been in a cabinet post before. The positions that he and his parties have staked out are moderate, in some cases even slightly to the right. He leads a bloc that's a merger of three different parties, I would say two centrist parties and one moderate right-wing party. I wouldn't expect huge differences between him and Netanyahu on matters of national security, but he does seem someone who's a little bit more willing to make concessions towards the Palestinians.
And if he were to become prime minister, and you've explained that that is a big if, how might that change relations with the Palestinians?
I'm not sure that we're going to see some sort of huge change or huge transformation. There's, you know, all this talk about the Trump deal, and we don't know exactly what's in there or not. You know, Washington is waiting to see what's going to happen in Jerusalem before giving away any details of that deal. You know, even though the Palestinians don't like Netanyahu, I don't think that, you know, Gantz is going to come in and say, you know, I'm going to give everything up now. So I don't think there's going to be some kind of instant transformation, but it could be a new era of talks.
And coming back to Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, he faces allegations of fraud, bribery.
He hasn't been officially indicted yet. The sort of final step before a decision about an indictment happened a couple of weeks ago, which was a pre-indictment hearing with the attorney general. If he's indicted for bribery, then it's probably the end or the beginning of the end for Netanyahu.
Lahav Harkov, senior contributing editor at the Jerusalem Post newspaper.
So that's Dan Damon from World Update speaking to one of the journalists from the Jerusalem Post. Martin, Benny Gantz is the guy who might take over if Bibi cannot. So is he going to be any better? I know one of the things to do with him is that apparently he's a little bit more or less aggressive towards the Palestinians than Netanyahu has been.
Well, yeah. Not really, because he was actually in charge of the shooting down of all of these protesters in Gaza, and that was his main electoral pitch. You know, I'm a general, I shoot Palestinians, vote for me. The right wing are dominant in Israeli politics, and of course, if you were to have a genuine vote, including all of the Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank, then you might have some serious. You know, they ought to actually have a one vote for all of those people. And ultimately, perhaps there will be. And then we wouldn't be arguing about what the right-wing Israelis want, because they would be outvoted.
Well, one of the questions that comes up again and again is to what extent is the Jewish state actually religiously Jewish, and to what extent is it secularly? Is it a secular Jewish state?
Well, I mean, there isn't really a definition of secular Judaism, is there? I mean, it just means that you've got a Jewish heritage if you're secular and you don't believe. But it's actually a religious belief. But the real problem is the discrimination against the indigenous community who've lived there for thousands of years, and that some of them do get to vote in Israeli elections, although their parties are never included in coalitions. Nobody will work with them. But of course, the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza don't get a vote at all. And you'd have thought, well, hang on a minute, they live here, they were living here. They see that you can't have a democratic state which is ethnically exclusive. It's just impossible.
The former vicar from Virginia Water in London, from the Church of England, Stephen Sizer, he's postulated that there is actually, he's in his book Roadmap to Armageddon, he's saying that bit by bit the Jewish state is moving towards, or the Israeli state is moving towards, almost inevitable confrontation with Iran. But on the way down the road, what they're doing is they're looking at the demolition of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They're looking at the exclusivity of the land of Israel for Jews only. What do you make of his analysis?
Well, I mean, it's quite clear. I mean, people need to listen more to Israeli politicians. They want war with Iran, and they want us to fight it for them. We've got to decide whether we want to do that. I don't think we should. We're going to build a naval base in Bahrain, where the local people don't want us to be there, but we have been told by the Americans to spend our tax money on building a naval base in Bahrain.
Well, I think there's quite a lot of people in Britain who want that too.
No, most people in Britain don't even know it's happening.
Well, I'm talking about senior, you know, MOD people, that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, those kind of people always want money spent on what they want, but most people are unaware. This is we withdrew from east of Suez in 1967 when we withdrew from Aden, and now we're going back into the Gulf, but of course the people of Bahrain do not want us there.
Oh, well, I mentioned Stephen Sizer in his book, The Roadmap to Armageddon, which is, it's pretty fascinating to see that it looks almost as inevitable that this is where the current Israeli, the Zionist state, is heading. But here he is, at the end of one of his talks, one of his colleagues also talks about the idea that if you actually test people's DNA, is there actually really any connection with Israel? But we're have a listen to Stephen Sizer, and then they move on to discuss that topic.
When Francis Schaeffer was near the end of his life, he was asked, if he had an hour with a sceptic, how would he spend it? He said, I'd spend 45 minutes pushing them to the logical end of their presuppositions, help them to see it's untenable, and take 15 minutes to share the gospel, because then they realize how good the good news is. If we can help Israel recognize that it is not a democracy, if it wants to be a democracy, which of the other two is it going to give up? It's got to choose one or the other. And so if we help Israel through non-violent ways, boycotts, divestment, sanctions, lobbying, as we did South Africa, the white government of South Africa, to recognise that it's not going to enjoy the privileges that we give other nations that respect human rights, that recognise the rights of its citizens as equals, then it will be more likely to choose land or identity as the way forward. So that's the choice. I have good Jewish friends who I periodically do a rain check with and say, how am I doing? If you know in your heart that your burden is to see peace and reconciliation in the Middle East, if I really believed the premillennial dispensational Armageddon scenario, would I really want my Jewish friends to go and live in Israel? Now, do I really want them to be, as Gershon Gorenberg says, an act three in a four-act play? You know, do I really believe that we've got to destroy Israel in order to bring Jesus back or a war in Armageddon? No, in our hearts, we must hold Jews and Palestinians together in our prayers. How do you deal with the argument of anti-Semitism? Well, it's very simple. You need to know the strategy that they're using. There's a very clear strategy. It's in the Hasbro manual. The first line is ingratiate yourself, i.e. Zionists will try and buy you. They will take you to Israel on all expenses paid tour. They will give you resources. They will encourage you to buy their line. If you don't, it goes from the carrot to the stick. And the stick is intimidation. They will intimidate you. So virtually everything that's been said about this debate last week on the internet is shooting the messenger, not critiquing the message. And when they start to shoot the messenger, you know you've won. Because if they can't refute what you're saying from Scripture, then you just have to put up with the flack that you get. Okay? So, intimidation. And they'll bombard you with emails, they'll say rude things about you, you're an anti-Semite, you're a Holocaust denier, whatever. If that doesn't work, the third level is isolation. They will intimidate others who shouldn't associate with you. And intimidate others. And if that doesn't work, they'll try and incriminate you, associate you with illegal activity and so on. How do you deal with it? Well, you just have to get used to it. Someone said, hot water keeps me clean. And the first time you get accused of something that you know isn't true, you get angry, you get hurt, you get defensive, you want to come to your own defense. But then the second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth time it happens, it begins to wear off. And it merely, it's like exercise. It actually strengthens your muscles when you begin to debate and begin to handle. But it can be lonely. Can be lonely.
Just a quick illustration of that out of my own experience, because to a Jew, I'm a Jew. To a Gentile, I'm a Gentile. My family was converted pre-Schofield Reference Bible by the loving care of a Huguenot family in Europe. Not by high-pressure evangelism, not by any sort of threatening things. My people were at risk. But these people risked their lives for us. This was long before the Second World War. And so my family still has a Jewish name. My name is Getman, giver of the get, which means I can give you a divorce certificate if you want one. I hope you don't. And all of my forebears have Hebrew names. I'm just about ready to do the DNA testing at National Geographic to find out what my historical route is. Roots, yes, but also route. We know we came from old Russia, where there was a massive conversion of Gentiles to Judaism in the 14th and 15th centuries. Many of the Jews that are in Israel now are Ashkenazi Jews like my family. I suspect I'm not going to find any Hebrew DNA in my test. On the other hand, our friends the Awads in Bethlehem have 80% Jewish DNA. So what's happening is the universities that were doing this testing in Israel, the Jewish universities, have stopped doing the testing because they found the Palestinians have more Hebrew DNA than many of the right of return Jews.
Martin, that's a pretty interesting, I think, observation there by Mr. Getman, a friend of Stephen Sizer's. And I understand that even the BBC have ventured a few years ago to do a programme about...
It's the Horizon programme, yeah. And the Israeli embassy made such a fuss that the BBC pulled the programme. And, of course, what it shows, I mean, there's also there's been studies, you know, because DNA analysis now is absolutely amazing because we can really trace where people come from. And that they discovered a tribe in Zambia who'd always claimed that they were Jewish. And, of course, the Westerners, when they first came into contact with them, they said, this is ridiculous, you can't be Jewish, you don't look Jewish. They're basically Zulu, they look like Zulus. And they said, yes, we are. And they said all they showed all the customs that they had, which were Jewish. And guess what? They are. They are Jewish. Originally from what is now Israel, Palestine. Then you had a big Jewish civilization in what is now Yemen, and then of course a lot of those people ended up in Africa. And as also said, the Khazars converted to Judaism in the Middle Ages, and they became Jewish by conversion. But of course they'd never been in what is now Israel, Palestine. They were originally from the steppes north of the Crimea. Now, in actual fact, that just shows how identity is actually plastic and malleable.
But we still hear all
not
the time.
Merely as straightforward as people think.
We hear
you know.
All the time about the right to return, don't we?
Well, how can that be? You know, the right to return to a place you weren't from in the first place is basically, I mean, you can't, the modern era, there's been all sorts of migrations and fights and movements in history, but you can't, I mean, Kosovo today has got a majority Muslim population, but in the Middle Ages it had a majority Serbian population, and they regarded it as the homeland of Serbia. But of course it isn't today, because the population is largely Muslim, and that's why they went to war, and they're still at daggers drawn about it. You can't go back and redo history and say, well, we used to control that, we want it now. But the modern state system is based on the idea that where people are is where they're supposed to be, and they can't kick other people off and replace them. That's what we fought about in Bosnia.
The right to return also is something which is being championed by the Palestinians, and they're getting shot by people like Benny Gantz and his friends.
Well, indeed. Of course, there are many Palestinians, millions of Palestinians living in refugee camps in Jordan and in Lebanon, and they can't even leave the camps because they haven't got any paperwork that says that they've got a right to be where they are. And they're in a complete limbo. What about their right to return?
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
On the trail and the tale of Nazi Party's brute of a treasurer, Martin Bormann now. This week, the Bristol Connection, Jewish refugee and local journalist who tracked Bormann down in the 1970s and paid for his trouble. And also a photograph of Martin Bormann, which I'll put up on the show page later at thisweek.org.uk. If you'd like to have a look at that, taken in the Argentinian capital, Buenos Aires, in the late 1970s. So, his name is Stuart Stephen, and he's a Jewish reporter. Back in the days where you could get promotion through doing good journalism, as we were hearing about Julian Assange. I mean, really, Julian Assange perhaps should be by now, Martin, the editor of the Times newspaper or the Daily Telegraph.
Well, he's not in that position at the moment, is he?
But anyway, Stuart Stephen, so he was born in Hamburg to Jewish parents in 1941. Stephen fled to England with his parents as a refugee. In 1959-60, he got a job at the Western Daily Press here in the city centre before the Temple Way place was built. And in 1964, he moved on to a national newspaper. That's a pretty quick career progression up to the Daily Express, Beaverbrook's paper. In 1972, he was working very closely with Hungarian journalist Ladislas Frago, tracking Adolf Eichmann and Josef Mengele, etc., in South America. Now, Martin, this period of the early 1970s, where there was also a World in Action programme all about Mengele, there was a lot of interest, wasn't there, in getting some of these escaped war criminals to justice?
Well, if you remember the Frederick Forsyth book and film, The Odessa File, that kind of dramatised this sort of thing. But of course what ultimately happened, as you know, that after Eichmann was taken from Argentina, the Jewish community in Argentina went back to the Israelis and said, don't do that again, because we're doing quite good business with these ex-Nazis, and we don't want you rocking the boat.
So you're saying the Israeli state was responsible for closing down the investigation into
when Eichmann was extracted from Argentina, the Bormann organisation based in Latin America Basically, Bormann was a gangster. He has got nothing against Jewish people as such. He's quite prepared to work. And, of course, the right wing in Israel, the Jabotinskyites, modelled their movement on Mussolini. And they even spoke to the Italians and the Germans about, do you want us to fight the British for you? Will you give us, if we fight the British for you, will you give us Palestine? And so all of that stuff, you know, the right wing in Israel are basically crypto-fascist. There's no doubt about it in my mind.
So, in 1972, working closely with Hungarian journalist Ladislas Farago, that was on Saturday, the 25th of November, 1972. The Daily Express had an exclusive front page, Martin Bormann Alive, and an article inside saying, "You are Bormann," with a picture of the Bormann that they had found over there. The Vatican, apparently, and President Juan Perón were said to have been complicit in his escape and protected him.
It wasn't just the Vatican and Juan Perón. It was obviously MI6 as well, because of the book OpJB by Ainsworth Davis, who was the actual...
Well, he said the actual author on the book is Christopher Crichton, but he had to use that.
Yeah,
he felt he had to use it because of, so he didn't get sued under the Official Secrets Act. His real name was John Ainsworth Davis.
At the end of the World War II, the Nazi intelligence structure was basically absorbed lock, stock and barrel into NATO as NATO was being formed. So Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head the Gestapo, ends up heading the BND, the West German Intelligence Services. Klaus Barbie, the butcher of Lyon, ends up working for the Bolivian army, training them in torture techniques as an employee of the CIA, who at the same time ended up killing Che Guevara.
I think Brazil also had its fair share of Nazi war crimes.
Well, indeed, that's right. So they were generally moved over there. And of course...
And that's, by the way, I don't know if you've seen this, but that's where Ghislaine Maxwell is supposed to now be. Yeah. She's managed to get over there. We have heard nothing very much about this international child sex trafficker, London debutante, but no, child sex trafficker, who knows everything about everything to do with all these children who've been trafficked over the years. No arrest, hardly any news story, but apparently she's hiding in Brazil.
Well, that's she'll be hiding with Bolsonaro, won't she? Incidentally, Bolsonaro and... various other people are all going to Saudi Arabia for a great big shindig this week, like a sort of Davos in the desert. And all of these, the Pompeo, anyway, all these people are all going to it.
Before we get off the subject of Bristol's very own Stuart Stephen, he was the author and the journalist behind these, the Daily Express headline, a Daily Express exclusive, Martin Bormann is alive. That was on the Saturday, the 25th of November in 1972. On Monday, the 27th of November, just 2 days afterwards, here he is speaking to a journalist, and this was up on the archives of the Associated Press.
The difference between this story and every other Martin Bormann story since the war is that we have got total documentary evidence for every word that we say. We have managed to infiltrate the secret services of several Latin American countries. We got those documents out of Latin America. We have them in our possession. Every word which we write, we will be able to produce a bit of paper to say that this is not what we are saying. This is not our version of events. This is the version of events as recorded by people whose professional concern it has been since the end of the war to track and record the movements of Martin Bormann.
Documents which relate to, what do they relate to? Just a name? That he's living under at the moment, or what?
They relate to several names which he's living under at the moment. They relate to a situation whereby he went to a Pacific country in Latin America after the war. They relate to the negotiations leading up to that invitation to go to that country. And they relate to the basic fact that intelligence services have been monitoring his movements ever since. There is virtually nothing which this man has done which is not known. Now, there is no mystery about Martin Bormann. There's no mystery as far as the Latin American countries are concerned about Martin Bormann. They knew. There's only mystery as far as the rest of us was concerned. Now, once one had managed to open those safes, get those documents out, get them out of the country, then there's no mystery for the rest of us. And this is what we have managed to achieve.
So that's the Bristol-based originally journalist, Stuart Stephen there, speaking on the 27th of November 1972. Martin, just to put this in context, Eichmann had been taken out from South America in 1961. There were still, although the official line was, okay, Eichmann is going to be the last, there were still quite a lot of people, particularly Jewish people, who wanted to get some more of these Nazi war criminals, particularly ones who were above Eichmann's head.
Yes, but I mean, if you read Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, it became clear that the Bormann organisation was very keen to put Jewish business people into their structures because it was a way of kind of covering their own tracks.
Kind of camouflage.
Yeah, basically. And of course, it was very profitable for those who cooperated.
Anyway, things moved very quickly after that. Friday, 1st of December 1972, the Daily Express announced that they had been hoaxed. Quite how they figured that out, who knows. 1974, though, a couple of years later, Ladislas Farago, he'd been working with the Hungarian, published a book called Aftermath, Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich. And of course, these pictures of Bormann were posted, and I'll put a photo up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk last night, both of Bormann and of the picture taken 30 years after the end of the war. See if you can, I mean, certainly to me it's the most incredible likeness that I've ever seen. I mean, there's various doppelgangers around. Anyway, Stuart Stephen then went on between 1982 and 1992 to become the editor of the Mail on Sunday. In 1998, on the publication of the Bormann DNA report, which supposedly showed that the skull found in Berlin was Bormann, and there was an attempt to sort of put this to bed for once and for all. I mean, just one thing, Martin, it's almost impossible to do a DNA test of that sort of age, surely?
Well, I don't really know. I'm not an expert, but I think you can get DNA from teeth, even from from skeletons from thousands of years ago. So.
But also, these DNA reports aren't necessarily worth the paper they're written on. It depends who you're paying to do them.
Well, there is definite. I mean, Paul Manning, who wrote the book I just mentioned, was the senior US correspondent in Britain during the war. You know, the top guy. And he was absolutely...
The idea that he died in Berlin is pretty much...
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've got evidence from other people saying, well, he didn't die in Berlin because we extracted him. That's it all in the book Op JB, as you know.
And the thing is, ever since that book was published, Op JB, there's been a propensity of all these books talking about Hitler surviving the war and going to...
Well, that's what they're doing there, is they're just creating a smokescreen. Ultimately, what's underlying all of this is that senior Nazis did a deal with the Western powers at the end of World War II, and they were protected and they were used in the setting up of NATO as an anti-communist organisation and the Gladio structures, which eventually ended up carrying out terrorist attacks across Western Europe. That was all staffed by ex-fascist intelligence personnel. And that is the history of NATO. I don't see how anybody can dispute it, because, as I say, the former head of the Gestapo ends up heading the BND, the West German Intelligence Service. You can imagine what the KGB made of that.
It's fascinating to see that it was a son of Jewish emigres. He actually did come across as a refugee in 1941, that actually got the ball rolling on this story. Quite fascinating that he was from Bristol too, and Stuart Stephen died in January 2004. Now, there were also various stings on him towards the end of his career, Martin, some very serious ones where, for example, he published an article which was said to be, he believed, had been sent to him as if it was from Brian Gould, and it turned out it was from Michael, Michael Howard's son, a Tory, instead. But, you know, why would someone take the trouble to hoax him like that? If it wasn't an attempt to discredit him as an individual? It's a bit what we were hearing from Stephen Sizer earlier. The information can't be discredited, but you can try and shoot the messenger.
Yeah, well, you can imagine if he's been poking around in things that the deep state doesn't want you to know about, then they've got all sorts of different ways of making your life a misery.
Like what?
Well, like, for example, ruining your career by giving you fake information which you think is real, you publish it, and then you're discredited, which is what, of course, you've got to be careful about that, but it's very, you know, they could do things like threaten your children. They could kill you, like Michael Hastings looks, if he was assassinated by the CIA by hacking his car. So they don't do things like that. I say, hang on a minute, what about John F. Kennedy? What about Robert Kennedy? What about Martin Luther King? All pretty clearly, they've had a court case in the US, where a civil court has definitely concluded that the state murdered Martin Luther King, and it wasn't carried out by James Earl Ray, who's still in prison, and the family have talked to him and said, we don't think he's the killer.
So, I mean, we're chatting about Martin Bormann today, but the thing that's really, I suppose, the reason for that is that it does look as if there were some people in right at the very apex of the British state, including Desmond Morton, Winston Churchill, who possibly even earlier back into the war, we certainly know from August 1944, were collaborating with these top Nazis and offering them protection after the war.
Well, that's
the people who were the senior war criminals.
Well, it's also well known that the Japanese Kempeitai, their version of the Gestapo, they were let off largely because they'd been carrying out all these kind of tests with chemical and biological warfare on Allied prisoners, you know, filming them as they died when they'd injected them with this stuff. And they said, do you want all the information we've got on this? Said, yes. And they said, we'll give it to you, but you've got to let us go. And, of course, they were given a pat on the head, and the Western powers just took over all the information torturing their own prisoners to death.
I mean, there's also the fact that we could be looking at some kind of totalitarian state in the future. And so it makes sense to examine. I mean, in a way, the Nazis were a blueprint for any kind of totalitarian
state. Yeah, that's right. And, of course, this is why the Gladio structures, you know, the bombings of Bologna railway station, all the rest of it, this is fascist psychological warfare technique, but modernized and spruced up so that it looks more liberal, but in actual fact, underlying all of this is a virulent anti-communist ideology.
I would draw a parallel, in a way, between the way Stuart Stephen was treated, although he then went on to become a national newspaper editor. But there was definitely some serious bullying of him during his career for what he found out.
Well, that's
compared to Julian Assange. It's getting worse.
Basically, if you wander off the park that the deep state accepts as legitimate kind of criticism, then you're going to run up against this kind of stuff, and that's because they are as they are. They are basically criminal networks.
Time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8 now. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Green Party's Bristol Mayor candidate in next May's election, Sandy Hall Rutherford, and Gloucester's prospective parliamentary candidate for the Brexit Party, Richard Ford. Also, you heard just there, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. Find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. I'll leave you with Harry and Chris. I've just discovered rather enjoy their stuff.
Thank you so much for having us. It's nice to be back.
We're often told to be afraid of a lot of different things,
and we found it a bit overwhelming.
So we thought what the world really needs right now is a nice, fun song about fear.
Some people are scared of spiders.
Some people are scared of heights.
Some people are scared of posting photos online that don't get no likes.
I'm scared of throwing away my Crocs before they come back into fashion.
Back into fashion.
Before they come into fashion.
Some people are scared of not finding their passion.
Some people are just scared of dashes. Why are they so long? What are they hiding?
Some people are scared of expressing their emotions.
Some are scared to let themselves have too much fun.
I used to be scared that on stage my flies would come undone, but it's something that I've overcome.
See, everybody's had times where they've been quite scared. One person's dream is another person's nightmare. To all of you, we say stop right there.
Some things go boo, some things go hiss, some things go...
Have you done your flies up, Chris?
Yep.
It might seem ridiculous, whatever it is,
but you don't have to be scared.
I mean, there's a lot that's scary, but there's a lot that isn't.
There's kids dressed as pumpkins in post-Brexit Britain.
There's what we're faced with and what we do with it. Fear only has the power we give it. People are afraid of the craziest things.
Scared of close spaces.
Claustrophobia.
Scared of teenagers.
Ephebophobia.
Scared of spicy potatoes.
Alugobi phobia.
Scared of Jedi.
Obi-Wan Kenobi phobia.
Scared of spicy potatoes shaped like Jedi's.
Alugobi Obi-Wan Kenobi phobia.
Over the years, there've been so many fears which may well have kept us alive.
But even though these days we're safer than ever, the papers seem hell-bent on stoking up terror.
Of course, terrorism is scary,
but we don't think they need the free press.
Fight fire with fire doesn't make much sense.
Fight terror with terror makes even less.
In the UK, you're far less likely to die in a terror attack than getting out of bed.
Or going to work.
Or falling off a ladder.
You're three times as likely to be killed by a ladder. those rungy beasts.
What if they gave the same airtime to ladders as they do to terrorists?
B&Q would be put on a watch list.
Bob the Builder would be accosted.
Window cleaners would have a serious panic.
Cash in the attic would just stay in the attic.
We'd be worse than maintaining properties, but at least we'd be less afraid of minorities.
Some things go boo, some things go hiss.
We'll show you how easy fear-mongering is. So when I say ladders, you say, ah! Ladders!
Ah!
Ladders!
Ah!
That's how you do propaganda, kids. There's a lot that's scary, there's a lot that isn't.
Don't let other people make that decision.
There are swarms of ladders all over Britain. Fear only has the power we give it. Because we're programmed to look out for danger.
But we're no longer living in caves.
We're projecting that fear onto strangers.
You wonder how we got this way.
And when we start off afraid of the unknown, why does that lead to hating the unknown?
Spend any time investigating the unknown, and it doesn't have to stay as the unknown. This was a list that took us 2 minutes.
Of things that immigrants brought to the British.
Fish and chips.
Chicken cottage. A cup of Horlicks.
Up to tea at the Ritz, Marks and Spencer.
Whatever world you're in, we're only coming over if you've got Percy Pigs. The royal family.
The Mini Cooper.
Love it or hate it, Marmite's the same.
All our ancestors were immigrants too, so
it's technically everything anyway.
It's a lot easier to be scared of each other than focus on things that we share with each other.
Like spicy potatoes shaped like Jedi.
You can choose Obi-Wan Kenobi phobia. You don't have to be scared.
I mean, there's a lot that's scary, but there's a lot that isn't.
It's up to us to make out the difference.
Only together can we go the distance. Fear only has the power we give it. Fear only has the power we give it. Fear only has the power we give it. Do watch out for those ladders.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.